Hello, I'm Jason Klom. This is number 0884, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0884. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, you'll meet Maria Gallucci, who is the author of Raised in Silence, which deals with the fact that she and her five siblings were raised by deaf parents. At what point did she realize that her parents were different from other parents?
We were on a field trip to the Denver Zoo, and I was with my friend sitting underneath a tree because we were having lunch, and my mom was walking across the parking lot, and she was waving to me, so I was signing to her across the lot because that's my first language, ASL was. And then I remember Christy asking, oh, your mom can't hear or talk? And I think that's when I first realized that my normal was different from everyone else's.
Alex Grass, a writer of horror and weird fiction, is the author of a collection of short stories called Infernal Tramps, Tales of Weird Terror. One of the stories is called Infernal Tramps. What's that all about?
Infernal Tramps is the eponymous story. The short story is called Infernal Tramps, and it is more or less a spot-on descriptor. It's about this rail car that appears in the middle of the night to a man who lives out in the woods, and he's sort of a dissolute alcoholic, a disgraced school teacher, and he finds him like a creature that's dropped off the back of the rail car that is vaguely human but not quite human. And then over the course of the story, it grows into a human being.
Mark Hartzman, the curator of WeirdHistorian.com, is back with the weird story for the month of July. This one deals with Patience Worth, a prolific writer who wrote several books from the grave via a Ouija board through Medium Pearl Curran. Patience even suggested from the grave that Pearl adopt a child.
Curran wasn't able to conceive. This ghost intervened, and through the Ouija board, Patience Worth dictated that they should find a baby and adopt it. She gave a description of the kind of baby that they should look for, and she wanted the baby to look as much like her as possible. So they consulted the Ouija board, and they finally found a baby, and the baby did look like Patience Worth. And Patience Worth wanted the baby named after her, so they did it. They named her Patience Worth Wee. In those early years, the ghost was giving these new parents guidance on raising her, what to feed her, how to dress her.
And there's lots and lots of Stuff File news, dad joke theater, Sir Dudley's Poetry Corner, a morning shower thought, and of course, an idiot of the day. The guest Slater, the person who told you this was show number 0884, was Jason Klom, author of Ferris Bueller, You're My Hero. He was on show number 0879, so you can go back and listen to that interview with Jason. Thank you very much, Jason, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File program, a show that is listener-supported, fan-funded radio that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Well, let's get right to the stuff. I hope you're sitting down for this first story because it's pretty ripe. A German drug dealer serving time in prison has won a landmark legal ruling allowing him to mail semen-covered letters to his fiancée.
In the quiet words of the Virgin Mary, come again.
No, you heard right. I'm not repeating it. Prison officials halted the correspondence after routine mail inspections, citing health hazards to staff. Authorities punished the inmate with a one-week recreational activity ban. Gee, now I want their definition of recreational activity. The inmate challenged the decision, arguing it suppressed his sexual fantasies and violated his right to personal development. The Hagen Regional Court sided with the prisoner, finding no legal basis for the disciplinary action, Judges ruled health regulations protect inmates, not prison staff, making guards' objections legally irrelevant.
Come again?
Yeah, I know. The court did note one minor infraction. Semen containing mail technically qualifies as a package. Oh, I'm just leaving that alone. Requiring prior authorization, but declined to impose retroactive penalties. How long did the judges debate this issue? How many judges were involved? And I really, really need a translated transcript. A Lakeland, Florida man with an extensive criminal history has been charged, again, following a body wash theft at a Walgreens store. 47-year-old Gerald Cobbs, who is known to dress as a woman, was identified through surveillance footage after three suspects stole nearly $650 worth of body wash from the store on June 29th. Two accomplices distracted store clerks while the group filled bags with merchandise before leaving without paying. Cobbs, already jailed on a separate warrant, now faces an additional petty theft charge. He carries 27 felonies and 17 misdemeanor convictions, mostly theft-related, and he has served over 11 years in prison. Said Sheriff Grady Judd, "This suspect has made a career out of stealing." Yeah, that may be true, but I know one thing. He's going to be the freshest-smelling person in prison. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our first guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, Kansas City firefighters responded to an unusual rescue after a man climbed inside a portable restroom toilet and couldn't get out. The incident occurred at a World Cup watch party location. A driver for Patriot Portable Restrooms discovered the man when collecting units after the event. After the man refused to exit, a passing motorcycle officer was flagged down. When the door was opened, no one was visible until a head emerged from the tank. Firefighters cut open the unit to free the man, who was then hosed down by crews. The man said he climbed in to retrieve a Mountain Dew bottle dropped the night before. Damages totaled approximately $800. As I've mentioned in the program before, anything that I drop into a toilet, I consider gone. So the fact that this guy went in for a bottle of Mountain Dew is just foreign to me because while there are many people who like Mountain Dew, I am not one of them. In fact, I think of that drink as simply carbonated urine.
Mountain Dew will tickle your innards because there's a bang in every bottle.
No, I think I'll pass. Anyway, let's get to our first guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Maria Gallucci is a multi-award-winning real estate agent and proud CODA. That's short for Child of Deaf Adults. She grew up as one of six hearing children raised by deaf parents. She's also the author of Raised in Silence. Maria joins us from Denver, Colorado via Riverside.com. Hi, Maria.
Hi, how are you? I'm very excited.
I'm just tickety-boo. Thanks very much for being on the program with us. Why did you decide at this point to write this particular book? Because, I mean, obviously this is something that you've lived your entire life with, but why now?
I think it was 15 years in the making, and I always kept notes of all the stuff I was going to put in there. So when I wrote the book, Raised in Silence, it wasn't just about me being a CODA. It was a child of deaf adults. It was about, it's really about what happens when we stop assuming everyone's experiences the world the same way. And so I just wanted to spread awareness and let people realize that we're not as inclusive as we think we are. And so for me, it just gives a lot of tips on how whether you feel misunderstood, different, or like you had to bridge the two worlds. It's for anybody who's outside of that.
Which number are you in the six children?
So I'm the third to the oldest, which is unusual that I was the parents' interpreters, because it's usually the oldest one. And for some reason, I took on that role.
And how many girls, how many boys?
So there's four girls and two boys.
Okay. Because I come from a large family as well. And, you know, when kids get together, they try to get one over their parents. What did you do as a group collectively that you thought was getting one over on your parents, but probably not?
So we would always sneak out of the house because they can't hear the door. And then, so my dad actually installed this alarm system that, like, it chirped like a bird. And I was thinking, well, why would you install that? Because you can't hear it. So we'd still sneak out. And we just collaborate with each other because they couldn't hear if we were going out the door or in the door. So we always just did that. But then they had like these little, like the baby monitors. So they knew we were sneaking out anyways. So we never got away with it. We actually got in trouble.
At what point when you were growing up, did you realize that your parents were different from other friends?
I still remember this to this day. We were on a field trip to the Denver Zoo, and I was with my friend sitting underneath a tree because we were having lunch, and my mom was walking across the parking lot, and she was waving to me, so I was signing to her across the lot because that's my first language, ASL was. And then I remember Christy asking, oh, your mom can't hear or talk? And I think that's when I first realized that my normal was different from everyone else's.
What age were you at that point?
I was 5 because I was only in kindergarten. It was one of my first memories that I've always like remembered, because I know we don't like remember a lot of things from my childhood. So I felt like that's always stood out for me.
You mentioned that you had written the book because you wanted to share the differences that some families get or go through. What are some of the differences?
I think because I have to bridge the two worlds, and we were kind of like an outcast because people would make fun of us, or they would make fun of my parents because they talked different. And so for me, it was learning to pay attention, like beyond words, and we always pay attention to body language and make sure that everyone understands what's happening. And so I think that those are the skills that I wanted to teach people, because I feel like people always judge people who are different from there. And I think we all communicate different, but every single one of us wants the same thing to be understood. And that for me was so much for the book, because even if that helps one person see somebody else a little differently than they did, and that's what was worth the writing the book.
I've often wondered, because when one is speaking, one has, depending upon what part of the world they're from, different languages, different accents. Does that translate to ASL?
It does, and every country has their own language. Like, so I'm ASL, so that's American Silent Language, and so like British has BSL, so they have a different sign too. So it's not a universal sign. They're over 300 different sign language for the deaf and hard of hearing community.
And does it change? Because like I said, there are accents within even the same country. Does it change regionally?
It does, because so I was born on the East Coast. So I was born in New Hampshire, I moved to Colorado when I was little. So we were raised here, but some of the signs that we were taught back East is different from Colorado. So I know my Colorado friends always make fun of me because I say like favorite is one of them. So I would sign it a different way because that's how I was taught on the East Coast. So it's kind of like having accents in a way.
Are your parents still alive?
No, my mom had passed away 25 years ago, and then my dad actually just passed away a couple years ago, coincidentally of the same cancer.
Wow, I'm sorry to hear that. Is that one of the reasons why you wrote the book at this time?
Yes, I was hoping my dad would, because I've had it written for a while, and I was hoping that my dad would still be around. So he knew that I was writing the book, so he would be so proud of me. But seeing I'm the one who had to tell my mom that she only had 1 to 3 months to live as a young person, and with between that, her and my dad, the way the the doctor's appointments were completely different because my dad had access to the interpreters where my mom didn't. I had to interpret everything for her. So it was a very different experience.
Okay, so you mentioned that you're the third child, but you're kind of involved with sign language at an early age, and you also seem to be the go-getter within the group of six. Why is that, as far as you're concerned?
I think it was because I had to, when you're especially chirping for your parents at such a young age, you learn all of the stuff. Like, you learn the financial stuff. You learn, like, what an adult does. So for me, I think it made me grow up faster. And I was always close with my dad. And so I think that the other ones are, I'm shy in nature too, but they're more shy than me. And so I think that I just took on that role because I was willing to go and interpret. And now I help all of the deaf and hard of hearing people in real estate too. It's one of my main things.
In writing this particular book, Raised in Silence, obviously you're trying to reach to the hearing community for us to learn what it's like to be in a non-hearing community. But what kind of experience have you had in writing this book that the non-hearing community is very, very proud of?
I think that a lot of people who have read it and said that they, and that they're not with the deaf and hard of hearing community, they said that I've never seen the perspective of that before. And so for me, I was just hoping people would leave realizing that inclusion isn't about something huge. It's about slowing down, making eye contact, and asking someone how they prefer to communicate. So I think for me, it was trying to make awareness about making sure that everyone felt where they belonged.
When did you start writing the book? And by that, I mean, was it before or after the success of the movie Coda?
It was before, because it was 15 years. It took me that long to write it. Like, I found my old phone and I had old notes from like the early 2000s, like, in there. And so it's just a collaboration. And then I had it on my New Year's resolution every year. And then finally, last year, I'm like, I can't have it on my New Year's resolution because I will never finish it. So finally, I just finally said, I'm going to get it done. And then I finally just pushed on and got it finished.
You're an award-winning real estate agent. When it comes to houses, what is it that, again, we, the hearing community, take for granted that is something that is very, very important, or if not potentially dangerous, when it comes to houses and the deaf?
I think because I'm in the deaf culture, I know, like, you need a deaf friendly home, which means that it's the kitchen's open to the living room. So for me, being raised in that community, it brought like light to stuff what they need. And I think that I learned to listen and pay attention, especially to body language, because that's huge with ASL. And I always made sure everyone understand what's happening in the transaction. And I think that those skills that I learned as a child being in the deaf and hard of hearing community built my career in real estate long before I even realized that they were leadership skills, which is so important, especially when you're buying and selling a home. It's the biggest decision anybody will make.
Okay, you just mentioned that in a deaf household, it has to be an open concept with kitchen and living room. Why?
So they can communicate back and forth in sign language, because you can't just talk to someone around the corner. You have to physically watch them. And so for me, you have to be able to sign to them. So they always, it's, and even me, and I'm hearing, I need a open space too, because that's what I grew up with. And that's what I was always comfortable with.
I'm assuming you have to have doorbells that are hooked up to lights.
Yes. And the smoke alarms. And in case there's a fire in the house, the smoke alarms will flash. So they'll be able to see that.
Again, this book is, it's number two, I believe, on the best-selling list?
Yes. I have had number one, but you know how it always switches. But right this second, it's number two.
When you first started writing this, did you ever anticipate that you would have a best-selling book?
No, that was like, I was hoping, of course everybody hopes that, but I was like very pleasantly surprised how big it was and how many like communities it's actually outreach to, because it is about being inclusive and building awareness, especially at the place or for leaders. And so it's like a book to teach people how to be a better communicator. And I feel like that people don't always remember every conversation, but they always remember how you made them feel. And so that's what I wanted out of the book.
Absolutely. Maria, again, the book is called Raised in Silence. Thank you very, very much for taking the time to be on the program with us.
Of course. Thank you so much for having me.
Maria Gallucci, author of Raised in Silence. You can go to our website at thestufffile.com. Check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0884, and you'll find the link to Maria's site, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order her book directly. You're listening to the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
And now, Dad Joke Theater.
Last night as I was walking home, I passed a lemon loaf pie, a mayonnaise cheesecake, and a cold fudge sundae. I remember thinking, the streets are strangely deserted tonight.
Join us again for another Stuff File program, Dad Joke Theater.
There's still more guests, more news, and an idiot of the day coming your way on the Stuff File program. Stay tuned. The Stuff File program is a listener-supported, fan-funded radio show that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Sign up and find out about our rewards program. Being a patron doesn't have to be a long-term commitment. There's absolutely no obligation. You could join today and end whenever you'd like, but the time we have your support would be so greatly appreciated. We'd also love to hear your thoughts about the show and even your ideas for rewards. Join us for the ride. Join us at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram.
I'm leading a standing ovation for Canada. Hi, I'm Amy Sky. As a singer-songwriter and producer and a proud Canadian, I'm thrilled when artists around the world record my songs. You could say that's one way to shop Canadian. Let's all do our best to support Canadian businesses and protect Canadian jobs. Shop as if your country depends on it. Keep your money in Canada for Canada.
You're listening to The Stuff File, now with 25% fewer calories. Here's Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk to the author of Infernal Tramps, plus Mark Hartzman, the curator of WeirdHistorian.com, has a weird, weird story for the month of July, dealing with a writer who wrote from beyond the grave. We also have a Sir Dudley's Poetry Corner, a morning shower thought, and of course, an idiot of the day. But there's much more in Stuff File News right here, right now. A Mississippi woman was arrested after a traffic stop revealed that she was driving naked with multiple firearms and drugs in her vehicle. Officers pulled over 22-year-old Caitlin Maxwell in Ellisville, a town of roughly 4,600 residents. Maxwell was alone in a 2017 Dodge Challenger that smelled strongly of marijuana, and she appeared to be under the influence. A vehicle search uncovered three Glock handguns and two AR-15 rifles, one modified with a switch to fire automatically. Maxwell told investigators her boyfriend, 24-year-old Sean Cooley, used a 3D printer to manufacture the conversion devices. A subsequent search of Cooley's residence led to his arrest, and Maxwell was booked into Jones County Jail on multiple felony and misdemeanor charges, with bond set at $35,000. By the way, records do not indicate why Maxwell was, as one cop remarked, traveling buck naked at 9:40 p.m., but I want to know if that Dodge Challenger is going to have the seats steam cleaned. A St. Petersburg, Florida woman was arrested on drug trafficking charges after police discovered fentanyl concealed in multiple areas of her body during a late-night traffic stop. Officers pulled over a vehicle July 18th for a window tint violation, arresting 46-year-old Curtel McCray on a resisting charge. The passenger, 26-year-old Yanishi Smith, drew suspicion when plastic baggies containing a white rock-like substance were spotted near her seat. As Smith was escorted away, a baggie dropped from her person, which she admitted fell from her buttocks. Additional drugs were recovered from her vaginal cavity and left breast area during booking. All items tested positive for fentanyl. Smith faces felony drug trafficking charges and a probation violation, as she had recently begun a 2-year probation sentence for grand theft. You know, at what point do you seriously consider all of the places that you can hide stuff on or in your body? And is that a long internal conversation? A sole restaurateur with 2 Michelin stars could face prison over a dessert garnish. Prosecutors have asked a court to sentence the unnamed owner to 1 year in jail and fine the restaurant's operating company the equivalent of roughly $13,500 for using dried ants in violation of South Korea's Food Sanitation Act. Ants are not among the 10 insect species permitted for human consumption in that country. Wow, I'm just afraid that there is a list of acceptable insect species that you can eat. Anyway, authorities discovered the practice through diner photos posted in online reviews. Officials estimate approximately 49,000 dried ants imported from the U.S. and Thailand were used over 4 years. Local media identifies the restaurant as Evett, run by Australian chef Joseph Lingerwood. A court verdict is expected September the 2nd. Wow. The U.S. is an exporting nation, but who knew they were sending edible dried ants? And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our second guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, here's a story that, if you're old enough like me, and you've ever seen the TV show Petticoat Junction, just think of the theme song in your head. An Arizona man is facing felony and misdemeanor charges after allegedly stripping down naked and riding on top of a moving train in northeastern Colorado.
Come ride the little train that is rolling down the tracks to the junction.
The Sedgwick County Sheriff's Office identified the suspect as Daniel Ray Balance. Well, I guess he'd have to balance. Of Quartzsite, Arizona.
Forget about your cares, it is time to relax at the junction.
Authorities say he broke a window to board a Union Pacific locomotive before climbing onto the roof while it was moving.
Lots of curves, you bet, and even more when you get to the junction.
Witnesses report seeing Balance riding naked atop the train before deputies took him into custody on July 16th. Said the sheriff's office in a post, Daniel expressed his love of vodka, beer, and playing the banjo. Unfortunately, we had to separate him from those loves and the train ride. Well, you know what they say. Sober thoughts often turn to drunken actions.
Petticoat Junction.
And now, this.
The Stuff File presents Sir Dudley Piddley Havisham Sedgwick Smythe's Poetry Corner.
Erica, whose nickname was Ricky, had habits that were notably sticky. She bathed in a vat of honey and fat, and now getting dry is quite tricky.
And let's get to our next guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Alex Grass is a writer of horror and weird fiction. His latest book, a collection of short stories, is called Infernal Tramps, Tales of Weird Terror. He joins us from Brooklyn, New York, via Riverside.com. Hi, Alex.
So happy to be here.
Thank you very much, sir. Glad to have you here. First of all, you are, your own words, a horror and weird fiction. What do you consider weird fiction?
First, let's start with horror. Horror would be like the tropes you're familiar with. Vampires, ghosts, werewolves. Weird fiction would be something like you buy a wheel of cheese and it starts talking and trying to murder your pets. So it would be just like it's much more bizarre. And I think as a genre also it owes to, you know, like the people who appeared. And I wonder if it came actually from Weird Tales, the old pulp horror magazine, you know, the H.P. Lovecraft and Clark Ashton Smith were published in. It's just like horror taken to a bizarre level, I think. Yeah, that's pretty much it.
Are these the weird stories that ruminate within your brain?
Yeah, totally. You know, it's funny because someone asked me, how do you come up with your stories? And I was trying to think of like a recent instance. And I was driving my son to school in the city. I'm going across the Williamsburg Bridge from Brooklyn to Manhattan. And I see a pigeon. And I had this thought. It just popped into my head. What if there was a man who had a shotgun and he was just going around New York City and his mission in life was to kill all the pigeons? Just like out in public while people were grocery shopping and trying to take their kids to school. It's usually as simple as that. And, you know, sometimes I'll act on the idea, sometimes I won't.
Okay, so reading your bio, I realized that you actually went to law school.
I did.
When did you make the shift?
Well, probably it was the end of my second year of law school. And I actually had, you know, like quite a bad drinking problem. And I went to rehab for 3 months. And when I got out, it just something shifted. And I was basically constitutionally incapable of completing law school, which my mother, who is a lawyer from a family of lawyers, did not agree with. But ultimately, I found it very soothing and entertaining and just sort of fulfilling to read horror. And ultimately, I decided that I wanted to write it. That was about 8 years ago, I guess.
So were you going into law because, again, you were a family of lawyers, your mother was a lawyer? In other words, were you never really interested in that profession now that you think back to it?
No. And actually, I loved law school. And I still look at it as a very valuable experience. And I learned a lot about writing in law school. I think that, like, if there was an influence, or the influence as it played out in my family, was much more along my father's side, where everybody went into business, you know, sort of like white collar, but entrepreneurial. Of course, you know, like my mom was delighted when I said I was going to go. At first, when I said that I wasn't going to finish, she could have, I thought she was going to have a conniption, but, and she did, but ultimately, you know, the way things worked out, she's, I'll say this, she has my books on her shelf now. So there you go.
Excellent. So what is Infernal Tramps all about and why is it called Infernal Tramps?
Infernal Tramps is the eponymous story. The short story is called Infernal Tramps, and it is more or less a spot on descriptor. It's about this rail car that appears in the middle of the night to a man who lives out in the woods. And he's sort of a dissolute alcoholic, a disgraced school teacher. And he finds him like a creature that's dropped off the back of the rail car that is vaguely human, but not quite human. And then over the course of the story, it grows into a human being who is like him, you know, living out of doors next to a railroad track. So like, you know, classically we call that a hobo, I guess. But, you know, tramp is think a much more poetic word. Infernal hobos doesn't have the same ring to it, you know? It ends up that the tramp character, the one who's been discovered, has sort of like a nefarious designs. Not specifically against the, you know, disgraced school teacher that found him in next to the railroad tracks, but, you know, against other human beings. And it ends quite bloodily.
You mentioned that this particular character or creature kind of morphed into something. And all I kept thinking now is going back to when you mentioned Wheel of Cheese.
Yeah, well, the idea is to start with something benign and then morph into something sinister. You know, I have a feeling that the story wouldn't be as successful if it was a serial killer who then morphed into a wheel of cheese. That would be much more anticlimactic.
Would you be someone, because I feel that all authors are this way, would you be someone who would like to see your writings, especially Infernal Tramps, either on the small screen or the big screen?
Anyone who says no is a liar. any person who says no to that is an absolute liar, because it's just the times we've grown up in. You know, no matter how many books you read, there are very, very strong odds that you've seen more movies. Just, you know, by the nature of the way that the world we live in is designed, you know, there's many more screens than there are books, and it's been that way since I was a child. And it also informs storytelling. So the way that things are framed in terms of like showing and not telling, making sure there's action going on in your stories, that's very much, at least I think, and there is a lot of people who think similarly, it's from the influence of film and television.
So do you write your novels and your short stories cinematically?
Oh, I'm trying to think of if I can answer that honestly. I mean, it has to be yes. You know, I'm always giving that sort of answer because, like, you know, what I really would like to do is, like, do me a favor. Give me like 3 hours. I'm going to think of that question and I'm going to come back. And I probably still won't have an answer. I need to deeply and ponderously mull over the question. But I think it must be, you know, like I was a latchkey kid. I watched as much television as my son watches his iPad. Let's say that.
Well, I'm glad you brought up your son because, you know, we talked about your mom and how disappointed she was when you dropped out of law school. What is it with your children? First of all, how, I know you have 3 children. What ages are they? And do any of them want to follow in dad's footsteps?
Well, they're 20, 10, and 7. The one who's 10 is about to be 11. The only one who has any interest in the horror genre is the oldest, my daughter. But she has, you know, it's not quite the same. I guess it's more Japanese creators she's interested in, which, it's more and more common with people in their teens and early 20s. But yeah, I would say she's interested. I bought her a graphic novel of an H.P. Lovecraft story, and, she seemed to not want to just burn it or throw it out. So I must have been doing something right.
I know that you've written some short stories and you've written novels. What is the difference in setting out to write a novel? Do you set out to write a novel, or is it just a short story or novella that's run away with itself?
That's happened, but that's rarer. That's certainly happened. I've set out to write a short story and all of a sudden it's 30,000, 40,000 words. And, you know, it's closer to it's beyond novella even, and it's getting close to novel. But generally, if I write a novel, it's because I've sat down after deciding to write a novel. I find that short stories are easier to psychologically bear because when you're writing a novel, you know, waking up several weeks in a row and then eventually sometimes months, although when I write novels, I write them fairly quickly, it's exhausting. You know, there's no reprieve. You're coming back to the same thing again and again and again. And it's like, I don't know, it starts to be like, you know, like showing up at an office party and there's the Eddie Haskell of the group, you know, there as always.
You went to law school. You come from a family of lawyers. You write horror and weird fiction. Do any of your stories involve lawyers?
Oh, I don't think so. You know what? Gosh, I'm trying to think of one. Oh, yeah, you know what? Was it? Maybe the villain, Clara, in Black River Lantern, she might have been a lawyer. But nothing that's, like, very impactful vis-a-vis plot. I mean, it's like, if there's a lawyer in there, it's sort of, like, incidental, you know?
If you were to write a new novel that the protagonist was a lawyer, would your mom be proud? Or prouder?
She would certainly be prouder. My My mom congratulates me for making peanut butter and jelly sandwiches. I think she'd be proud if I did anything. You know, I have a nice Jewish mom. You know the joke, right? Like, how do you know that Jesus was Jewish? Because he was 30 years old, he lived at home, and his mother thought he was a gift from God.
Well, congratulations on the book, Infernal Tramps. Alex, thank you very, very much for taking the time to be on the program with us.
An absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
Alex Grass, author of Infernal Tramps, Tales of Weird Terror. You can go to our website at thestuffwild.com. Check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0884, and you'll find the link to Alex's site, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. You're listening to the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
Giving you something to think about. This is Morning Shower Thoughts.
I think it goes without saying that you should never make snow angels in a dog park.
Morning Shower Thoughts from the Stuff File program.
Got something for the mailbag? Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. Send your email to mailbag@thestufffile.com. And remember, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H. That's mailbag@thestufffile.com. Or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
The Stuff File program is everywhere on several stations and on several platforms, including YouTube.
The YouTube handle is youtube.com/@PeterAnthonyHolder-StuffFile.
That's kind of long-winded, isn't it? Just go to YouTube and type out my name, Peter Anthony Holder.
On YouTube, you'll find interviews, short vertical videos, and more. There's lots to check out.
Again, that's youtube.com/@PeterAnthonyHolder-StuffFile.
Oh, for the love of God, just go to YouTube and type in my name.
From our studios in Montreal, Canada, and going out to the rest of the world, this is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Now, the Stuff File program presents The Weird Story of the Month with Mark Hartzman, the curator of WeirdHistorian.com.
And here we are with the weird historical story for the month of July. And Mark, I think this story is the ultimate definition of ghostwriter.
Yeah, it really is. It's a story about a ghost who was one of the most prolific writers in history. Dead or alive, I guess you would say. So this is a story of a ghost named Patience Worth, who first appeared in July of 1913. And this happened in St. Louis. There were two women who were playing with a Ouija board. Their names were Pearl Curran and Emily Grant Hutchings. Pearl had lost her father recently, and so she and Emily thought, you know what, let's try playing with the Ouija board. Ouija boards were very popular at that time. This was a part of spiritualism, which was at a pretty high point in the early 1900s. This was a very common belief that we could communicate with the dead through different mediums in all sorts of ways, the Ouija board being one of them. Of course, people still play with Ouija boards in that way. So that evening, they're playing with the Ouija board, and eventually they find that they made some contact. The words came through that said, "Many moons ago I lived, again I come, Patience Worth, my name." And so they had this woman who said that she came from the 1600s. Her name was Patience Worth. She had moved from England to America. She was a single woman. And she started writing through the Ouija board to Pearl Curran. Emily Grant Hutchings kind of faded off into her own mediumship. She actually ended up channeling Mark Twain, writing a book of his called Jap Herrin, but that's another story. But Pearl Curran started channeling all these words from Patience Worth. And that included all kinds of different writings, from aphorisms to poems, plays, novels, even songs. And she was on stage singing these songs written by the ghost. The ghost, of course, really just wanted to write. She didn't really offer much of information about what it was like in England in the 1600s. She gave some general descriptions of her small village that was in southwest England, but really nothing more that told you much of anything. She didn't talk about the afterlife. There were no big questions about what happens after we die that were answered. She just wanted to write whatever she could write. And she did that quite a bit through Curran's hand. And what was interesting was that Curran, she liked literature, but really she never really wrote more than a letter. There wasn't like she was writing on her own before that, and then all of a sudden she said the ghost was writing it. She was just a housewife in St. Louis. She wasn't believed to be a highly educated person at that time. She just was kind of living a regular life in St. Louis. And so all of a sudden, with Worth's dictation through the Ouija board, she started producing all this incredible literature that people were really enjoying. And she was making headlines. I mean, ended up making headlines for decades. In 1917, she wrote her first novel called The Sorry Tale, which was about 600 pages. Which is a lot of writing through a Ouija board, if you can imagine, you know, letter by letter. Supposedly, this was happening very fast on the Ouija board. It was moving very quickly as it was being dictated. And Pearl Curran's husband, John, was helping as well, writing everything down. But you can imagine still 600 pages through a Ouija board just sounds, you know, remarkable. And this was a story about life during the time of Jesus Christ. So it was going way, way back, of course. And it got rave reviews, which is incredible. This book from a ghost, whether you believe it's from a ghost or from Pearl Curran, who really never wrote anything more than a letter, was getting rave reviews. One newspaper called it truly remarkable. The New York Times called it a wonderful, a beautiful, and a noble book. So this was the New York Times book review. Again, this was, you know, 1917. And then just a year later, 1918, she had a follow-up novel called Hope True Blood. I love this. On the cover, it was pitched as a mid-Victorian novel by a pre-Victorian writer, which I think is pretty funny. And the LA Times loved it. They called it a masterpiece. They said, one cannot escape the realization that here, no matter what its source, is a masterpiece. So again, rave reviews for however these books were being written. People seem to really like them.
Well, let's go back a little bit here. Back in those days, you kind of had to get a publisher to look at a manuscript and release a book. So who published this stuff?
The publisher was Henry Holt and Company. Henry Holt was a spiritualist himself, so he was inclined to publish these kinds of books about spiritualism. So it wasn't shocking that he would pick up a novel written by a ghost. Again, it wasn't terribly unusual to hear about ghosts communicating from beyond the veil during this time period. So it's pretty exciting that maybe someone was writing a book through a Ouija board. And so it got published and as we were saying, you know, did remarkably well. Beyond the books that she wrote and the songs and the poems and the aphorisms, she also wrote a magazine. So Curran and her husband, for a couple of years, from 1917 to 1918, they published Patience Worth's magazine. You know, that was just if you couldn't get enough. In addition to stuff from Patience Worth, the ghost, there were also articles written by the Currans themselves and a biographer, Caspar Yost, a newspaper editor in St. Louis. And he had written a whole book about Patience Worth in 1916 called Patience Worth, A Psychic Mystery. So he had already covered the topic and then he became a contributor to the magazine after that.
Let's flash forward a little bit. There was an adopted baby because of a Ouija board?
Yeah. So Patience Worth wasn't just busy writing. She was also helping the Currans start a family. Curran wasn't able to conceive. She'd been having trouble conceiving. This ghost intervened, and through the Ouija board, Patience Worth dictated that they should find a baby and adopt it. So she gave a description of the kind of baby that they should look for, and she wanted the baby to look as much like her being Patience Worth, not Pearl Curran, as possible. So they consulted the Ouija board, and they finally found a baby who was, they found her when it was 9 days old, and the mother was giving up for adoption, and the baby did reflect, from what they could understand, looked like Patience Worth. And Patience Worth wanted the baby named after her, so they did it. They named her Patience Worth Wee. She grew up as Patience Worth Curran. And in those early years, the ghost was giving these new parents guidance on raising her, what to feed her, how to dress her. So they were getting all kinds of information through the Ouija board.
What year was this baby born?
This baby was born in, I think it was 1916.
Okay, so it's quite possible that she made it to the 21st century. Was there any notoriety for this child beyond childhood?
There was a article I found years later that was still documenting her as the baby that was being raised on the Ouija board. So she was still getting press. Early on, when she was just a toddler, there was headlines across many newspapers I loved that said the baby being raised by a ghost. But years later, it was still being tracked in the press. So to some degree, yes. But, you know, she eventually married, and Pearl Curran died in 1937. And after that, Patience Worth sort of faded away. People didn't really hear about her anymore. She didn't come back through another medium or anything like that. So the writings ended when Pearl Curran died. But before then, until 1937, so 1913 through 1937, Pearl Worth dictated nearly 4 million words.
I'm kind of hard to believe that if this were all true, that Patience Worth wouldn't just simply give up the ghost, literally, because her medium died.
Yeah, you would think that she'd want to keep writing because she was so into it, right? But this kind of leads us to some theories of what else might have been going on. Maybe it wasn't actually a ghost, right? So naturally, there were people studying her, trying to figure out, okay, what's the deal with Patience Worth? Is she for real a ghost? Or is there something else happening with this woman, Pearl Curran? So there were various psychical researchers, psychologists who were studying her. There were some thoughts that maybe this was all through the subconscious of Pearl Curran, that she was writing, you know, it was her subconscious at work and coming out as this personality. Could have been a multiple personality disorder. But there was also some curiosity about that because Curran and Patience Worth were interacting at the same time. Curran could be on stage talking to people and then deliver messages from Patience Worth to a live audience. So that made it a little hard to believe that it was a multiple personalities situation. But there was also that idea of just purely from the subconscious. There was a psychologist named James Hervey Hyslop, who was fairly well known at that time in the early 1900s. And he wasn't buying it, even though he was also a psychical researcher and really fascinated by this topic. He was frustrated by the fact that Caspar Yost, who I mentioned wrote Patience Worth, a Psychic Mystery, didn't really do any hard research into the whole situation. The Currens didn't want to be researched by psychologists, really. They kind of declined any attempts to research them. And Hyslop just felt like, okay, well, she grew up in the Ozarks. One of her husband's favorite writers was Geoffrey Chaucer. And he kind of felt like this weird language that Worth was writing in was almost like a mixture between the two, this sort of weird, archaic style of speaking that she was writing in. So, you know, there were different theories of what was going on. But yeah, it certainly does make it curious that Patience Worth just disappeared. And one other thing that kind of puts a little bit of a damper on the idea that this ghost just happened to appear out of nowhere is that there was a novel published in 1900 that was had a character in it named Patience Worth. And people knew about this, and it was brought to Pearl Curran's attention, but she dismissed it. She said she hadn't read it, at least not before Patience Worth appeared to her. But of course, who's to say she hadn't read it at some point, maybe even forgotten she'd read about it, just went into her subconscious from that way. The book was called To Have and To Hold, by the way. So that's a little odd that there was it's a random name, Patience Worth, to have just come up, you know, not too long before this ghost appeared.
Has anybody tried to, with the Ouija board, tried to get in contact with either Patience Worth or Pearl Curran?
You know, that's a good question. I should look into that some more. I hadn't come across that as I was looking into the life of Pearl Curran. But I should look into the potential afterlife of Pearl Curran and see if people have attempted that. I got to think that they probably have. It would be fun to hear the ghost of Pearl Curran talk about the ghost of Patience Worth.
Well, maybe they're on a celestial plane together.
They could be, without no longer needing the Ouija board.
Exactly. Mark, thank you very much once again. Which one of your books is this in, by the way?
So I wrote about Patience Worth in The Talking Dead, which collects a lot of different alleged words from the afterlife into this particular book. So I have some sample writings from Patience Worth in that book and a brief overview of who she was, a little bit of what we just discussed. And you can find that through Curious Publications.
Do you and your family kind of sit around with a Ouija board?
You know, my daughters bought one years ago, but we never played with it too much.
Thank you very much once again, Mark.
Thanks for having me.
Mark Hartzman, the curator of WeirdHistorian.com and also the publisher at CuriousPublications.com. He's the author and curator of several books, and as he mentioned, this story comes from The Talking Dead, a collection of messages from beyond the veil, 1850s to 1920s. You can go to our website at TheStuffFile.com. Check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0884, and you'll find the link to Mark's site, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his books directly. You're listening to the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. And finally, in this section of Stuff File news, before we get to the idiot of the day, a Rotterdam museum has spread more than 800 pounds of peanut butter across its floor, honoring Dutch artist Wim T. Schippers, who died last month at 83. The installation called Pindakaas Floor, or Peanut Butter Floor, was originally created by Schippers in 1969. It is now on display at the museum for 2 months. Two employees spent several days applying 40 buckets of smooth Colvay brand peanut butter across a 270-square-foot hexagon using drywall trowels. By the way, Shippers also voiced Ernie and Kermit the Frog in the Dutch version of Sesame Street.
Laat je speelgoed staan, schuif gezellig aan voor Sesamstraat. Voor Sesamstraat.
The museum warns allergy sufferers at the entrance. Staff directed opening visitors to simply follow the smell. Yeah, that's not an enticement for me. And boys and girls, it's that moment you've all been waiting for. It's time now for the Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for the Strange Things Adults Do. This stuff I'll present, the Idiot of the Day.
Florida Agriculture Commissioner Wilton Simpson noted that someone had stolen multiple Smokey Bear and other signs from various forest areas from Pensacola to Orlando. The Office of Agricultural Law Enforcement got a big break when 30-year-old Hunter Drake Lovett of Pace, Florida, allegedly tried to sell the stolen signs on Facebook Marketplace. He wanted $1,900 each. During the investigation, Simpson posted photos of a storage unit where Lovett was allegedly storing more than 500 stolen signs. A special agent was brought in to witness the arrest. Smokey Bear himself, or at least a guy in a costume. A federal grand jury has indicted Lovett for theft of government property. He faces up to 10 years in prison. Now, why? Oh, why? Would you post stolen Smokey the Bear posters on an open forum like Facebook Marketplace, where authorities can look at it at will? One reason, and one reason only. You're an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program, number 0884. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com. And once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number. And once again, that's 0884. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook, Spoutable, Mastodon, and Blue Sky as PA Holder. Check us out on patreon.com, where you can become a patron of the program. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including over the air on stations like
World FM New Zealand,
WNRHLPFM Newport Richey, Florida,
KZZHLPFM Eureka, California,
WFNULP St. Paul, Minnesota,
CKUWFM Winnipeg, Manitoba,
CFMU Hamilton, Ontario,
CKLU Sudbury, Ontario,
Local 107.3 FM St. John, New Brunswick,
CHSR Fredericton, New Brunswick.
Plus, streaming on any streaming service your little heart desires. That's it. Bye-bye.
Sir Dudley here. You've been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. There are some people who still debate who the best cinematic Spider-Man is. Some people are adamant about the first one. It's a case of Toby or not Toby. That is the question.